My name's Heather Goodall. I've been working in history for about 30 years now, for a long time. I was researching Aboriginal social and political history in the early 1970s, and I went to talk with Aboriginal people in communities, and what I was expecting to find was stories about wages not being paid, about labour exploitation, about bad housing and discrimination. And instead, what I found was people wistfully talking about their sister whom they'd never seen again. And they might talk about a child that they'd had as a young woman who disappeared, and despite their efforts, they'd never been able to find them again. And in the early 1970s, what I was beginning to hear about was something which is not written down anywhere at all, which is the way in which it felt for a sibling or an aunt or an uncle or a grandparent to lose a child and to mourn that loss all their lives.
Yeah, baby will take them away somewhere else. Yeah? She could come back and sit down with family. Might come back and learn a language.
My mum was living with her white father and Aboriginal mother. The old grandfather went to Wyndham to get some stores, and while he was gone, the police raided the camp and took them at daybreak.
This story wasn't well known at all at the time, and I wasn't expecting it. And it then enabled me and other researchers. There was some extraordinarily sound research done in those early days by people like Peter Reed, who looked at the archives as well as listening to what people were saying.
I was lucky enough in the year when I was writing my PhD thesis on Wiradjuri people, with permission of the Archives Authority and the old Department of Aboriginal Affairs in New South Wales, I was given permission to read every record that was held on Aboriginal topics by the archives. At that time, and this is to say something about in favour of records, it wasn't until I'd finished reading all the records that I realised there was a policy to, in a way, eliminate part Aboriginality in New South Wales. And in a sense, the people who had the experience didn't quite realise that after at all either. They realised that their own families had been taken away, but it seemed to be either an act of God or else it was something that happened because our families were deficient in some way, didn't want us or couldn't care for us. But no one had quite worked out that I ever spoke to that it was, this is how I interpret the policy, it was actually the purpose was to eliminate part Aboriginality. That came out from the records. Having done that, then I and people from Link Up and other historians began interviewing people around the state who'd been removed. Then the oral history came in to not only to support that thesis, but to complicate it too, that some people were glad they'd been taken away, and some people had very, very close and loving relationships with the people that they grew up with. Some people enjoy the institutions, but, you know, I'm not saying that didn't happen. Of course, it's an extremely complex story. But nevertheless, the complexity of the oral history was able to substantiate what appeared to be the central story emerging from the written records.
I think one of the most exciting things that I've done recently was the work I did with Isabel Flick, who was a senior Aboriginal woman in Western New South Wales. But despite being a very imposing and a woman used to public speaking and very used to negotiating with white fellas, the first interviews that I did with Isabel that we recorded were very formal interviews where she waited for me to ask questions and expected that I would shape the interview. But she came to me one day that we'd planned to do an interview, and she walked in the door and said, "I've been up all night thinking about this and I know what I want to say for this chapter." And she sat down and we turned the recorder on.
I just want to say that again, Isabel, because I had the volume turned right down. I couldn't work out why it was coming in. Yeah, go on. Just say that again. Thinking about that.
Yeah.
Where is Creek?
Thinking about that incident, I realised after, many years later.
And she just began and gave this wonderful oral, rhetorical account of a chapter that she wanted to call Confrontations.
One of the things I said I wanted to talk to you about today was confrontation. It's funny how our life began with that confrontation. Watching it, you know, watching how the cops could walk in the door, and to see how our people reacted to that kind of questioning about when are you going to work, where are you working, if you're not working, why not, you know.
And it was very powerfully structured and the content was very strong, and she'd been thinking about the way that the experience of confrontations had shaped her life for better and for worse. And she told this story so wonderfully that in the end she died towards the end of our work together, and I was left with her family to put the book together, which we did eventually with lots of tears and lots of hard work. But I think in the end her voice came through, but probably nowhere more strongly than in that chapter, which we called Confrontations, and it did just what she wanted it to do. It told her story in the way she saw it. That happened a couple of years ago, and that really summed up for me the great power of people being able to tell their own stories.
That kind of confrontation sort of, I suppose, conditioned us as we went. I remember when I stood up in that theatre that night saying, you know, take these ropes off, what do you think we are? Our money's as good as anyone else and we want to sit where we want to sit. And even though I said it as calm as that, I was so sick within myself. And then you hear your own mob saying, oh God, she's making a shame, God, you know. And one or two old people, there's one of the stalwarties and someone else, they just said, good on you, Isabel, it's about time that happened.
We could say 50% of what we know about Aboriginal Australia has come from books, that's true, only 50% from oral history. But in terms of the experience which Aboriginal people have had, 100% comes from oral history. There's nothing in books which hasn't been drawn from oral history. We would know nothing if Aboriginal people hadn't been prepared to go out and talk.
We've got the so-called history wars that have gone on in public in Australia over the last few years, but they've involved a very small group of people like Keith Windschuttle who have claimed that documentary evidence is somehow more trustworthy than other sorts of evidence.
Windschuttle is unusual in this day and age in that he really does trust documentary sources, which normally means official records, as if they were not simply human voices written down within a particular political and social context, and mistrusts oral sources because they are spoken directly. That's a false opposition, I think. Both kinds of source have to be assessed according to the same critical criteria. So I think he's simply being old-fashioned there.
What does the book Kayang and Me tell us about the value of this kind of work?
Kayang and Me is a very, very interesting history written by a Noongar man who'd lost contact mainly with his people. His father was a Scot, and his aunt, Hazel Brown. You'd probably know Kim Scott's novel, Benang, in which he examines the horror of being white-ish in a society obsessed with race. Then he went on to research his Aboriginal family's history from the archives. And he came up with a whole lot of information and he came up with a whole lot of questions. And then, by accident, more serendipity, he found out about an aunt of his called Hazel Brown, who turns out to be the family historian. She's a custodian of the stories. She seeks the stories out. She investigates the stories.
Well, Kimmy is my dad's cousin's son. I didn't know that Tommy Scott had a son called Kim until he came to my doorstep and introduced himself to me. He said that he wanted to find out who his family were and where they really came from. Well, I opened my heart out and told this boy everything I knew about his family, because his family were our family as well. We sat down and talked and talked and talked. Kimmy was interested. Then he said to me, Adi, I think we should write a book.
You watch them composing a history together out of their very different sources. He has the archives, she has the stories. Now, what the book demonstrates to you is that archives are just written down voices after all. You know, they don't have some other quite separate source of authenticity. Someone is speaking and the voice has been written. And what I think it would be fair to say they found was that Hazel Brown's information was a great deal steadier, more reliable than her nephew's, but it was still not great. I mean, there were contradictory stories. She had to sift them. She had to think about them. She had to compare them. She had to work hard to establish what had really happened. While her nephew's notes from the archives often proved to be useful and as often proved to be hopelessly corrupt, you know, hopelessly muddled and confused, because the people keeping the records had no notion of the social dynamics of an Aboriginal society.
That's Black Seed, performing a Welcome to Country at the recent conference of the International Oral History Association, held in Australia for the first time. The conference was a great opportunity to see oral history in an international context. There were about 400 delegates from 30 countries and up to 7 concurrent sessions taking place over 4 days, so a lot of papers, and many of them were simultaneously translated into Spanish, reflecting the large Latin American contingent at the conference. It was clear that oral history projects have a particular urgency in places where trauma and political instability are within living memory. A major theme running through the conference was set by the keynote address.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce the most imaginative and premier Australian oral historian, Peter Reid. Welcome, Peter Reid.
The truth which will set us all free. National reconciliation, oral history, and the conspiracy of silence.
I now declare that the hearing of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is now in session. We are charged to unearth the truth about our dark past, to lay the ghost of that past so that they will not return to haunt us, and that we will thereby contribute to the healing of a traumatized and wounded people. For all of us in South Africa are wounded people. And in this manner, to promote national unity and reconciliation.
With the Nuremberg war trials setting the example, the decades since the war have seen truth commissions held all over the world, from Guatemala to Ghana, Yugoslavia to Nepal. The most famous, of course, has been the post-apartheid South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
What kind of man are you? What kind of man is that that uses a method like this one of the wet bag? What kind of human being is that, Mr. Benzin?
Mr. Benzin.
And what effect has that torture activity done to you as a human being?
Mr. Yingeni, not only you have asked me that question, I, Jeff Benzin, have asked myself that question. I, Jeff Benzin, approached psychiatrists to have myself evaluated to find out what type of person am I. Yes, Mr. Gingeni, I did terrible things. I did terrible things to members of the ANC. As policeman and upholder of the then law of the country, I had to prevent deeds of terrorism. I am not trying to condone my methods of operation. I am trying to convey that circumstances under which I was working at that stage.
The regime, the Truth Commission's criticised for allowing people to make testimonies and not being punished for it. To me, that's an issue of the hour. In 50 years' time, we'll be very, very grateful that the South African Truth Commission functioned the way it did, because we'll have the evidence then. So that'll be such a valuable resort for other historians and, more importantly, the nation to come to. And I'm talking about the children of the perpetrators as well as the children of the victims. You know, 50 years on or 100 years on, that's how peace is made, by saying these are things, the kind of things that happened. You know, when the Myall Creek massacre reunion was happened in, when was it, 1998, I suppose, when that memorial was opened, we had hand in hand perpetrators, descendants, and victims, descendants, walking together and crying together, because we know a little bit of what happened, enough of what happened. We know who the perpetrators were. So it's so important to get that original testimony. You know who the perpetrators were. Then you can have a reconciliation. And maybe we can't do it in our lifetime, but we got to, you know, we're historians, we've got to think of the future. And that's where oral history can be so valuable. If we don't know what they did, it's much more difficult to reconcile.
But for oral historian Sean Field, the TRC alone was not enough to heal the nation.
For some TRC speakers and officials, they had a sort of biomedical understanding of healing, that people could be cured by a quick cathartic fix in the TRC process. I prefer not to use the notion of healing. I think the word has become somewhat abused. I've used the notion of regeneration, which what I mean by regeneration is, how do we sustain the positive effects of catharsis, of people, the insights that people gain through oral narration of their memories and their stories? How do we sustain that beyond the interview setting?
Sean Field sees a particular role for oral historians to pick up where the TRC left off. Since the end of apartheid, the heritage sector has grown in South Africa and there's been a proliferation of community museums.
The District 6 Museum is, for me, the most profound example of social regeneration we've seen in South Africa.
Each group brought a little something to add to the colour of District 6.
For those people that don't know, District 6 is an iconic Cape Town community that experienced forced removals. And the community has gone through a restitution process, but critical alongside the legal restitution process of getting their land back and having houses rebuilt, these houses are being rebuilt as we speak, was this process of creating a museum. This museum started off a group of activists who were involved, and a group of academics who were also involved in it, historians and some oral historians, engaged with the community during the transition period. This is around 1993, 1994, to set up a temporary two-week exhibition on the District 6 story. What started off as a temporary two-week exhibition has not shut its doors to this day.
An inspector came to me one day, knocked at the door, and said to me, you are Mrs. Ibrahim? I said, yes. He said, well, I want to tell you that all the land here will be expropriated and that you will be forcibly evicted from District 6. So I said, like hell. And I'll write and tell the world of the rape of District 6. And I did.
The fact that these stories, represented both visually and orally, triggered such an incredible response from community members and, of course, beyond, you know, District 6 residents as well, gave practitioners, both historians, museum curators, and community members who were involved in that process, such a motivation to continue the exhibition that it's become the premier community museum in South Africa. And I mean, there's no doubt that the various projects of the District 6 Museum and what has become the District 6 Museum has had a profoundly regenerative effect, both at an individual level and in a collective community sense. And it is now the model for other communities around the country to follow. And that regenerative process is going to carry on. I think that the last part of the regenerative argument is that it has a fundamentally historical understanding embedded in the notion. It's about the next generation. You're not only disseminating into the community or
into other communities, he also disseminated to the next generation.
Oral history, it's gone way beyond its original intentions, and I think the expectation that it will somehow become a formal and esoteric academic discipline was misplaced. I think it is. I think there's a great deal of very sophisticated work done about memory and testimony and the narratives which people generate. But I think the really exciting part of the ways in which oral history has gone beyond its original project is this empowering of a much broader community. And with the internet as well now, the ability to communicate around the world so that we can hear the stories from the occupied territories in Palestine, for example. We can hear those stories today when they are being told today. We can hear what it feels like for people who are standing at the checkpoints and can't get through. We can hear what it's like for people in South Africa trying to make sense out of post-apartheid South Africa. We've got ways to understand what it's like in Middle America, trying to make sense out of the events that are happening there day to day, so that we have the opportunity with new means of communication as well as community empowerment to go a long way down the track of understanding the way we learn about the past and how we use it in the present.
I absolutely believe that oral historians have a persona, that they have a special mission, that they have a fantasy world about what's happening, and at the same time, more than the historians of the 19th century, I think that oral historians often want to have a fully human narrative. They grow out of that sense in the 1960s that society is important, that it's not just what's happening in the nation state, but that in democracies and in industrial societies, that ordinary people count. They're the citizens, they're the representatives, and their voice needs to be heard. So there's a great deal of politics behind that, just as there is behind the scientific history of the 19th century.
Is it okay for historians to have a political purpose in doing history?
I can't imagine how an historian wouldn't have a political interest in doing history unless they were a complete sort of antiquarian who just liked pottering about, because it's quite a tough thing to do. It's lonely, it's arduous, the results are always uncertain, always unsatisfactory. So I think one has to have a political purpose. But the political purpose has to be cast in very broad terms, I think. I think it needs to be concerned with increasing humankind's ability to understand what it does. It has to be that kind of open curiosity. Now, your political sympathies might be indicated by the slice of humankind you decide to examine. Working class, women, a religious cult, whatever. But your purpose has to be to make as clear as possible what it was these people thought they were doing, with that being critically evaluated, so you can see what else these people might have chosen to do. You know, I think the usefulness of history is that it lets us study unintended consequences. Ideally, history would expand the role of reason in human affairs.
The Struggle of Memory Against Forgetting was written and produced by Catherine Franey. The sound engineer was Judy Rapley. Thanks to all those who contributed to the program, and you'll find links and references on our webpage. I'm Sharon Davis. Join us next week for Hindsight.